Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts. A semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Appalachian Gothic. And it's about, well, it's about a lot of things, but it's mostly about Bonnie and the Mere Mortals. And our guests for this episode are some folks who know something about the band Bonnie and the Mere Mortals, and the blending of the Gothic aesthetic and of the sort of American musical heritage. The actual members of Bonnie and the Mere Mortals. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. And can you introduce yourselves, I guess, individually? What you play, what you do, what you are?
So I'm Bonnie, and I play the guitar and sing, and also do some occasional banjo and whatever else we end up doing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Pretty much utility player.
Yeah, I'm Dustin. I mainly play lead guitar and sing and sometimes synths, and I also engineer us in the studio.
And I'm Mike. I mainly play the upright bass. And that's pretty much it.
Weird synth noises.
Weird synth noises.
We all kind of do a little bit of everything.
Yeah, we all kind of come from a background where he has his own studio, I used to work in a studio, and she has a studio, so we're familiar with all that kind of stuff.
So you're like pure hardcore music geeks then? Really full-on technical...
You could say that.
You know, you have opinions about microphones.
Oh, yeah.
So I've had friends in bands before. Is that... who've kind of experienced this in either way, is that like sort of limiting or paralyzing?
Well, each one of us is sort of different, right? Like, Mike's very much like a tinkerer. He finds old things and makes them awesome. Destin is very much like the best highest end stuff around. He knows the ins and outs of everything. And I'm sort of like the punk rock of how cheap can I do this and what cheap tricks can I use to make it not sound like trash.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, because I've had friends who, like, will very much do, like, not full-on, like, My Bloody Valentine, spend a week recording the tambourine part. Because there's one song in Loveless where they spent a week just on the tambourine.
Yeah, I couldn't do that. Yeah. No.
Yeah, but, like, how do you manage that, then? Like, that, like... not wanting to be absolutely perfect but still good? Because I guess you can go full Kevin Shields, right? You all have the knowledge and ability to go Kevin Shields.
Well, I think that we kind of all have a sense of, you know, what too far is and what sound we're going for. Mm-hmm. Like, we still like sounds that aren't pristine. We like sounds that, you know, are kind of... You know, help me out here. Like,
yeah, I think we let the aesthetic drive primarily.
Thank you.
Yeah, because like I come from a background where I'm used to trying to make everything really pristine and perfect, and so this has been like a big shift for me because I've really wanted to do something that explores like grittier textures and letting the spontaneity really drive it, and so it's been a really interesting balance for us.
So, and I think we keep each other in check very well too. You know, when one person's doing something, we're like, maybe you shouldn't worry about that.
Sometimes we have the complete opposite instincts on something.
Yeah,
but
that happens sometimes.
It's cool because usually from it comes a synthesis of something that we could have never planned on just individually.
Right, yeah.
And I guess that a lot of that just comes from, like, trusting each other then.
Yeah.
Then anxiety.
Yeah.
So what is, I guess, for folks listening at home... or wherever the hell you're listening to this thing. Those of you listening on the bus, so what is your aesthetic? Like, how would you describe Bonnie and the Mere Mortals?
I guess I'll take that.
Yeah.
So this for me came from a deep desire to express both the sides of my own sort of dichotomy of like growing up on a farm and having like weird hick instincts and also being a member of the goth community, and like, I have a literature degree, and I spent most of my degree studying the Victorian and the Gothic and whatnot. And there's such a deep literary tradition of Southern Gothic and all of that. And I couldn't understand why no one's expressed it musically. And if they do, it's not really anything genre-wise. Like, they are working with those themes, but no one's really said, hey, let's put goth rock or new wave or, you know, shoegaze or something and actually mix it with a folk or Appalachian or country or whatever sort of aesthetic, which is strange because all of those stories are very similar. If you read an old Victorian ghost story and if you, you know, listen to a cowboy story or something like that, they're the same themes and the same sort of aesthetic, sometimes even the same clothes, you know.
This is true. And so, oh, that's fascinating. So, and I mean, it sounds incredible. So you have an EP out called Tennessee, which sounds incredible. That's why I was asking about the production, because it just sounds so good. But yeah, thinking about this blending of aesthetics is so interesting to me, because I there was a time in my life when I came from this notion of maybe like, well, old stuff is not where innovation comes from, you know, but yet there is a heritage and a history in your sound that you talk about, and you can hear when you hear the EP. And it's so fascinating to me, is like, now when people use, you know, it was sort of a relatively new idea to me of using this sort of a musical heritage as a grounds for innovation.
That's part of the problem that we have sometimes when we record, is that we want to keep both aesthetics alive. So we're trying to figure out, how do we keep like the folk aesthetic, the you know, like the traditional things mixed in with, you know, the gothic. And because, you know, she comes from a background that might surprise you, she, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go ahead.
But you were in like heavy metal bands pretty much, right?
Yeah,
so it's a big jump to come from that to here. And I'm, you know, I think all of us are kind of the same way. Mm-hmm. Because I used to do like psychedelic music. I grew up on Pink Floyd and Radiohead and, you know, stuff like that. So we all kind of just mix it all together, and then we kind of make sure that we have both of those aesthetics and see how to fit them together. And that's the challenging part.
Well, it creates a really rich sound, because you do have like the kind of the weird synth or the, you know, shoegazy elements and banjo.
Right.
Which,
for me, it's like trying to not rely heavily on the sounds that you already have in your head. Mm. Like, it's, to me, I don't think of it as much as like, how can we cram a banjo in here, but rather like, how do I get rid of the like five tunes that I already have in my head that would go with this that I've heard before, and do something that's like authentic to our sound?
That's a better way to explain it.
That's because it's hard, because it, a lot of things we're doing, it would be really easy to just throw another like big washed out guitar with some chorus on it, or in other songs we could just throw another folk instrument on it or whatever, but it doesn't have, you know, just trying to find the actual feel. And it's, you know, I've never thought about what you were saying, like heritage sound with it. I've never thought of it that way. For me, it's just trying to create something a little bit different, but not necessarily, what am I trying to say?
Formulaic.
I think it's interesting because a lot of our songs have like a very traditional song structure that is familiar to a lot of people. And so, like, I think when people listen to our music, they're able to access something about it where it's like, yeah, that's familiar. But we try not to just rely on the cliches that come to mind when you write a song like that. And you think, oh, well, let me just do it like, you know, every other pop song that's been written for the past 40 years that sounds similar to that.
Yeah, that's exactly what, yeah. It's like accessible weirdness. You
know? Yeah.
Accessible authenticity, you know.
Yeah, which, yeah, and I think part of that, too, is I think for me, like, you know, a song like 309, which has these, which is great, I mean, because, like, in terms of genre, like, so it's a Dear John song, beautifully, but it's not, like, the vocal delivery is not cliched in it, that it sounds necessarily bitter. Mm-hmm. There's almost a tenderness to, in spite of, like, what that song's about, which is, you know, this hasn't worked for a while, I'm getting on the road.
When we were writing that, I was thinking about, you've met my husband, Travis.
Yes.
I didn't get him to listen to goth music for like pretty long time. Like, we had been dating for like 6 years or something.
What?
And it, because if I think someone's going to make fun of something that I like, I just don't share it with them. I just don't know what. So he'd seen me wearing a bunch of Susie and the Banshee shirts, but he'd never heard them, I guess. And he got in the car once, and Susie and the Banshees was on. And he was like, wait a minute, who's this? And I was like, oh, it's Susie Sue. He's like, this isn't Susie. I'm like, oh, yeah? And he's like, but she's goth. I was like, yeah. And he's like, but this isn't sad. It's happy. I think about that all the time. Because some of my favorite things about, like, old new wave or, like, goth rock in general is writing really sad songs that sound happy. It's just one of my favorite, you know, The Cure have a million of them.
I agree. I love that. The juxtaposition.
Which is something that's done in folk music a lot, mm-hmm. too. Mm-hmm. You know, just having these really happy-sounding songs that are about, you know, everybody getting typhoid or something.
Which I think, I mean, there is also, I mean, there is, like, an emotional complexity and richness there. And it allows, like, you know, I was saying to you guys, you know, to prep, I, like, listened to that EP, like, 6 times today, you know, and still, there's still something there on the 6th listen, which, you know.
That's great.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's important to sell. But also, it's a weird way, you know, I had a professor in college who just talked about how art, good art is a celebration of all aspects of the human experience.
Okay, yeah.
And for, you know, which was interesting because I had him for a horror film class. And, okay. And he had to say, no, this still works. We are celebrating, well, yes, death, fear, all of those things. And it's so important in artistic expression
right.
to not limit oneself to one set of emotions, but mm-hmm. to try to engage in some way in all aspects of the human experience.
Right. Every part of the human experience is valid in writing, in art. For sure.
Yeah, I think talking about those sorts of things bring us together, you know?
Yeah.
Like, letting everybody know that we're all gonna die, or that we're mere mortals, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, the mere mortals, yeah.
Which is appropriate, your podcast name, and yeah.
I was thinking, I said no overdubs, but I was thinking, like, you know, I probably have a sample of a rim shot somewhere that maybe for the intro... Just gonna keep going, I think. We're just gonna keep going. But yeah, so I think it's also then for me, one of the things I find that's sort of interesting about the music, you know, and even also a song like Tennessee, that was, you know, the other song that really struck me today listening was, you know, and there's that line about Appalachian skies. And I was thinking to myself, like, oh, you know, this is, we're in this kind of weird nationalist moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost feels, I think, for a lot of people, like our country's been sort of taken away from us. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Like having pride in American music. It's like, yeah, but there's bro country. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's like it got stolen. Like,
yeah.
Shit, you know? Like, where did the Carter family go?
Right.
You know? Right? It's been ripped off from us. And so you can't. And I think for me, it's interesting, like a song like Tennessee or whatever, and thinking about, again, you know, Appalachia is this place that nobody wants to own. It's someone who, I write this really bad professor I had in grad school, who I will not name, and it kills me that he had such a good line. He says, you know, everybody always says Appalachia is that place that's a little farther south from us. You know what I mean? Like, we would never admit that, you know, Western Pennsylvania is Appalachia, but, you know, here we are in Appalachia. And, like, having that, like, pride in place and sense of place, and again, that musical heritage that this band taps into, and yet being able to do that in a moment where also a lot of people, especially folks in the country, believe lots of really ugly things.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know? As you know, you guys are all familiar from here. Are you guys both from here originally?
I'm actually from Nashville.
Okay, oh, there you go.
Yeah.
I can't remember if you know, when, what you...
I mean, I basically grew up here, but I was born in Nashville.
But, Appalachia, to me, you know, when you look at the history of things, it's like, this is where unions started. This is about people, like, carving out their own place and telling everybody else to fuck off, you know?
Yeah.
There's such a great history of that. Like, coal mines were one of the first industries to pay anyone of any race the same wage, you know? Yeah. This is where a lot of, like, union things started, and there's a really huge level of, you know, different types of people here, but I think, you know, people who are queer or people who are, you know, people of color and stuff just get massively erased, you know, from the rest of the country, and say, oh, well, that whole part of the country is just crap. We're just going to forget them. But there's plenty of people here trying to make laws better, trying to make things better. Mm-hmm. And you can't do that if you just crap all over where you're
right.
from.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is hard. You know, I'm thinking of it too. I have a friend who, because of familial, a parental health problem, I should say, had to move back to Central West Virginia. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I love the place. She loves the place. She is invested in that community, but also having all those frustrations, you know. And yeah, like West Virginia, like if you go to West Bank Arena, they have the mural depicting the founding of West Virginia because it happened in Wheeling. Mm-hmm. Does not mention slavery.
Right.
Does not mention, like, that's why we left Virginia, right. is because we were abolitionists.
Yeah.
And what a point of pride that should be for Appalachia.
Right.
But, yeah.
I wonder if there's a way to, like, make a bridge. I mean, this is grandiose, you know, but maybe there's a way to make a bridge between those two sides with music.
Well, that's sort of what I'm trying to do.
Okay.
Talk about that.
Because goths and the, you know, people who love electronic music, subculture people, let's say. Subculture people and people who like country music do not like one another.
No, yeah.
But they have far more in common than either one would like to believe. And, you know, part of me just saying, like, well, the stories are a lot the same, you know? Just looking at gothic stories and old country, you know, if you're listening to old Hank Williams or something like that, you're going to find a lot. And I mean, Nick Cave got it.
Yeah, Nick Cave did get it. Yeah.
So, but to me, it's just talking to people constantly are like, oh, I like anything but country.
And right.
It's like, yeah, I don't like Luke Bryan either. You know?
Yeah.
So, and I mean, you get it playing in a folk band. So
yes.
I'm sure that's a lot of what it is. And y'all are all pretty granola-y.
Yeah,
You're more on the NPR side of folk music than the Jim Bob side.
Right.
Yeah.
I just play the bass.
But yeah, so you're working on a new record. What's songwriting like then for the band? If you we talked a little bit about recording earlier, but in terms of the songwriting process.
Recently we've been doing a little bit more in the studio, but first the ideas came from Bonnie, and then we would kind of try them out in a live setting, but then Destin is the master, and he's usually all excited and puts all kinds of instruments and frames of songs and arranges them, and then we kind of like reconvene and decide what we like and what we don't like.
Yeah.
So it kind of goes always.
Yeah, it's a little different for every song. I mean, most of our songs usually start with an idea that Bonnie has, and, you know, sometimes she'll bring in lyrics, but maybe doesn't have a melody, and so then we'll just kind of throw chords to it. But usually the songs evolve very naturally between the three of us, and I feel like we all contribute something to every song.
A lot of them, it's been like we each have a different step in the process. Like, I'll come up with, like, just a simple song structure and some lyrics, and then be like, something like this, and we go back and forth, and, you know, like Mike said, but we've also had plenty that we just came up with on the fly with each other. My favorite one, as far as the way we wrote it goes, is Without Me, which is going to be on our upcoming album, because I had a melody and I knew what I wanted to sing, but I didn't know what was underneath it. And Destin has perfect pitch. That jerk.
Yeah.
So I was just like, I kind of want to sing something like this. And he just started playing something underneath me. And within like an hour or so, we had a demo together. So, which is like a magical movie moment for me.
So how did the band come together then? Because it seems like there is a,
I came up with the idea and thought I had an existential crisis and bought a bunch of recording equipment and then did like the University of YouTube and put together a few demos. And then I found Destin on Craigslist.
Yeah, I was on Craigslist one day. I was really bored with everything I was doing musically. And I had actually for years had the idea of like a Southern Gothic project because I had read a lot of the literature and I had heard music that kind of suggested that it could be possible, but I never really saw that it was a genre. And so I'm just searching on Craigslist and I see Southern Gothic. I'm like, are you serious? Somebody in Pittsburgh? So I had to contact her.
Yeah, I was like, what? Somebody else?
Yeah, right.
I figured like, all right, well, I'm not going to find anyone who likes what I'm trying to do necessarily or understands both sides of it. So in my head, I was like, I'll find like two goths and two like country pickers and I'll just mediate between them all the time. That was like the initial idea. I'm like, no, it's going to work, you know? But then, so I found Destin and then, I went to the Millvale Music Festival.
Yeah.
And I was drunk and went up to the mic and was like, hey, how many bands are you in? And he said, one. I was like, cool, you want to be in another one? And he gave me a card and I sent him an email drunk. And later I was like, he's not going to email me back.
I did.
That's great. So, yeah. So what else I want to talk about? Tennessee EP, American music, the gothic. So who are the sort of literary influences?
Tell you know.
Well, people at the other end of this microphone might not know.
Actually, I just finished a book series of books that I really, really love that I feel like is going to maybe influence some stuff called Blackwater by Michael McDowell. Are you familiar with him?
Books for chumps.
He's like, has to be sitting in a room with, 5,000 books? Michael McDowell is the guy who wrote all of Tim Burton's, greatest hits. Guy who actually wrote the stories. So he wrote Edward Scissorhands and stuff. But no one knows who he is as an author, except Stephen King. Stephen King, apparently.
Yes. Yeah.
The dude. But that and, there's a book of poetry that really inspired me to do this called Incident at the Edge of Bayonet Woods. I can't remember.
That's at my house right now. I need to give it to you.
Yeah. But it's a linear book of poetry that takes place right after the Johnstown flood. Mm. And it really perfectly encapsulates the hopelessness of growing up in a crappy Rust Belt town.
Mm.
But then, all the greatest hits of gothic crap,
Understood. Justin, so you said you're from specifically from rural Pennsylvania.
I'm from Avella, which if you spit is West Virginia. I'm 10 minutes from Wheeling. I grew up on a 103-acre beef cattle farm.
Oh, wow.
About a half an hour south from Star Lake.
For those Yinzers out there, half an hour south. But you're right near the border.
Yeah. Most of the time it's easier to just say I'm West Virginian because it's closer to the truth,
Right.
But wow, the Johnstown. Sorry, my mom's from Johnstown. That blows my mind.
That story, that's crazy. I still can't get over that.
Yeah. Yeah, both. I mean, all three floods. So, 1889, just 1936, and I was actually born during the 77 flood.
Okay.
My mom was in New Jersey, and my family in Johnstown got the call. My mom got into labor.
Wow.
And then the phone lines were washed out, and Johnstown was cut off from the rest of the world for about a month.
Wow.
And my parents got a call from somebody who was like, hey, I'm a ham radio operator from, the next town over or whatever. I'm talking to somebody who says he knows your father and would like to know what happened. We're all okay. Because the first 2-3 weeks of my life, my parents didn't know, how their families were even.
Wow.
Yeah. But yeah, Johnstown is such a place that, oh, just the you know, talk about like the resource curse that like rural communities have, where if you have some, if you have wealth in the ground, then everything else is just wrecked. And nothing else really matters. Which is, I think, also a huge part of the Appalachian story.
Yeah.
Ours, the town that I grew up in, I always tell people it's like, if you've ever seen the movie October Sky, I'm always like, that's sort of what my, you know, that's a villa. But we had a huge coal mining industry that was really vibrant. We had a movie theater and a bank and some stop signs. And then they found some Native American artifacts and they shut the whole coal mine down. So everyone in the town lost their jobs, and the town never recovered. So it's just lots of empty trailers, the bank building's empty, there's, you know, everything's knocked over, and now we have four beer distributors, a two-lane bowling alley, two clowns, and one stop sign. So
and that's exactly what happened in Butler, where I grew up. And then, I hate to say this, but then you think about Billy Joel in Allentown. I mean, it's the same thing.
But I just think that's an experience that, like, a lot of people grew up
on,
and a lot of people don't want to talk about that experience, but it's such a common thing that, that brings a lot of people together, is just talking about the crappy town you grew up in, but no one wants to own up to. And I'd rather write some stuff about it, because there are authentic stories that, that come from there, and those are real hardy people that are worth knowing sometimes.
Yes, I agree.
Sometimes, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it is weird, I mean, home as painful, home as loss. You know, I think for me, I always spent two weeks every summer at Grandma's house in Johnstown. And it was sort of magical for me. And it's weird, like, growing up from New Jersey. Yeah, it's beautiful. There's horizons everywhere. Like, you grow up in New Jersey and you get a backyard fence and the strip mall parking lot. Like, that's as far as you can see. And just that there's hills. And I still have friends from home who come visit out here. And it it reminds me of how even special and weird-looking Pittsburgh is.
You know?
It's just, like, yeah, it's like everywhere you can go, you can see something, you know? It's like... And for me now, the big initiative or redevelopment initiative in Johnstown is to just knock buildings down.
Really?
So my grandparents, the last sibling, the day the last of my grandparents' siblings was buried, they were also knocking down the bar where my grandfather used to hang out after a shift at Bethlehem Steel.
The whole town's probably like jack-o'-lantern teeth.
Yeah, the whole thing is just like, it's amazing. You know, I go out for family events every 6 months and just buildings are just gone. I was like, wait, what was there?
Right.
What was, you know, so there's also, I think, with your sound and these stories, a sense of history that almost is on the cusp of like being gone forever.
Disappearing, yeah.
Yeah, or is like something that grad students in the 2021s or whatever.
Which is hilarious talking just like in America, because to anyone in Europe, it's like, oh, like I've bred older than America. But on the East Coast, we have this like feeling of old buildings. And,
It's 100 years old or whatever.
Right. There's some kind of weird shame or something involved in it. I don't understand it.
Yeah, I know. Well, my sister-in-law's like, you bought a 100-year-old house for the second time? Like, yeah, I don't want to live in a development with construction. This house is actually made out of wood.
Right.
The floors aren't straight. There's not a right angle anywhere in this house, I don't think.
Yeah.
I feel like culture as a whole is sort of moving back a little bit to those sort of, you know, everyone's buying shiplap to put on their walls and, and stuff, you know. So we are getting more of that, but it's... It's funny to me that a lot of the places with the most sort of backward people are the prettiest.
Yeah.
You know, and all of us, you know, the artsy people generally gravitate towards the city where we can't appreciate that as much. Right, but, you know, there's a lot to be said with how absolutely beautiful these old houses and old mountains and, you know.
Right. I mean, I love the city, but I also love... You know, being out and going to the lake and fishing and and doing things like that. I mean, that's one of my favorite joys, so I can't live without it, so I don't know.
Pittsburgh's,
you know,
a good city for that, though.
Yeah.
For fishing?
Yeah.
Well, just for, I think Nashville's in the same. A lot of the, like, places along Appalachia are, like, very green cities.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, very green.
You know, lots of trees.
I mean, Pittsburgh's weird because you drive, like, 5 minutes and you hit wilderness. And, like, there are people on septic tanks who are within the Pittsburgh metro area.
Yeah, right. Still paying Pittsburgh taxes, but they have a septic tank.
Yeah, which also, I think for me, and not to get into even, like, the notion of, like, ruin porn, like, not that I don't watch a bunch of those YouTube videos, but for me, yeah, it's like, even, you know, whenever I drive through West Virginia, like, I just want to stop so many. This summer, we went from Morgantown, well, I guess Fairmont, to Wheeling on US 250, and there were so many places where I was like, I just want to pull over the car, and I just want to look at that building that's this, like, urban looking, like, late 19th century hotel that's in the middle of the country that looks like a building that would be on the Southside Flats.
Right.
But there is nothing else like it.
Do you think that people appreciate that as much anymore, or is it just...
I think it's just folks like us.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think... No, Dan Bell is making a living on YouTube.
Okay.
Going into...
I love those videos.
I love those videos too. Yeah. But Dead Mall series... I love his Baltimore, so I can't do another a dirty room. I can't. Like, it's just too gross. It's too weird. It freaks me out too bad. But a lot of his stuff, when he goes into, like, abandoned Baltimore and talks about... Because, I mean, Baltimore is also a city that, you know, has just been vacated by and erased and redlined to death. And he goes into those places, and I always... am so intrigued by it. At least he tries to be respectful of the space, even if it's a ruin. Like everybody else who does those videos, most of those people are just idiots.
Have you ever seen Abandoned on Vice?
Yes,
Viceland? I love that show.
Yeah,
I mean, there's so many cool things that he goes and visits, and you meet all kinds of people that are still living in that culture.
Yeah, which I think for me is also a thing. As we're my big phrase, just to explain all of the American weirdness right now, is just that the part of it is the 20th century is dying. And it's dying right, literally, like people from Harold Bloom just died today, that guy for the Cars died last week. You know, everybody is, you know, whether they're literally physically dying, but also because of whether it's the economy, the environment, a lot of even like 20th century ways of living.
We're going through an entirely new industrial revolution in a sense.
I think we get caught up too much in like the dualism in general, but especially speaking as like our generation, we have one foot in analog and one foot
in digital.
And everybody wants you to choose sides. And even with what you're talking about, like going into old buildings and stuff like that, is like, is it disrespectful? Is it not? Like you have to, everything, you have to pick an opinion.
Yeah.
And whether you're have any education on it or not, like your opinion's strong and you're mad at everybody else.
Right.
You know?
Yes.
And at least personally, I've been trying really hard to catch myself when I get caught up in dualistic thinking of left or right or analog or digital.
Though I will say in the analog digital, I'm on the side of Steve Albini. I am on full Steve Albini, you know, as we start lathe cutting these podcast episodes. I did look at that machine. There is that machine you can buy now. You can buy your own record lathe for like $1,100 now.
Yeah.
And you can just start.
That would be cool, though.
That would be cool. Yeah, just vinyl podcast. I think the blanks are $10 a piece. Yeah, that'd be great.
That would do great.
That would do great. Well, you know, and it was like, it was cassette store day this weekend, and it was record store day, and I even know someone in town here who is, it's a weird idea.
As long as A-Tracks don't come back, I'll be okay.
A-Track day.
I have, actually, there's a guy, Miguel, who is obsessed with A-Tracks. He fixes A-Tracks, and for the right price, he can make your band an A-Track.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, but you gotta,
don't you have something that's, like, dumber than that, though? You have, like, some sort of other...
Well, I have the 8-track of the movie genre, which is the CED Selectivision video disc.
Okay.
I have a player. I actually, so for my birthday this summer, I bought a Laserdisc player. So this is how, though that's digital, but I don't believe in obsolete formats. Right. I still have a computer here with a floppy drive.
There you go.
Windows 7 machine, but it has a floppy drive. Yeah. And I can turn it on and use my floppies if I need to.
Yeah.
Turn on MS-DOS and play Oregon Trail anytime you want.
Yes, I can.
Oh, yeah.
And I have the vocalist from my music project is a Mac Classic with Apple Talk. A 1990 Mac Classic with Apple Talk run through a pedal board. But anyway, so the CD Selectivision disc is the format that bankrupted RCA. Okay. It is a record. It is a record, vinyl record, with a magnetic coil in it that has the magnetic information that can show a movie.
Kind of like tape.
Kind of like tape, but it is embedded in a black disc.
Okay.
And RCA spent $600 million developing this technology. Under the understanding that a third of American households at least are going to want one of these things.
Right.
It took them 20 years. It came on the market after Laserdisc.
Yeah.
And at the same time as VHS.
Oh, wow.
No one bought them, but my favorite part about the format is the records where the video discs come in these plastic cartridges.
Mm-hmm.
Because in order to get, you know, 60 minutes on a side of a record, you had to put the grooves super close together,
mm-hmm.
which meant then you had to put this lubricant. There's one kind of vinyl lacquer that you can put the magnetic coil in.
Okay.
And then there's one kind of lubricant that you permanently put on the record. The problem being then is if any dust gets on the record, permanently fuses.
Oh, it fuses.
It permanently fuses, rendering the film inoperable.
Oh, wow.
Or it does this weird Salvador Dali, like almost like record scratch thing, and it'll jump 5 minutes ahead.
Yeah, right.
Or whatever. So they were like, oh man, so what do we do? I know, we'll put them in like these plastic cartridges that you have to then feed the entire cartridge in the machine so that the disc itself never sees the light of day.
Wow. Okay.
Yes, and then halfway through you have to like turn the movie over, you have to reinsert the cartridge and pull it out and flip the movie. Yeah, so I have that. I have that, and I have about 300 discs.
Okay.
In my basement.
I mean, that's awesome. What are you going to do with them?
300 discs is about 6 movies.
Yeah, yes. Right.
We keep saying we want to have like movie night. Like, we'll just make a big thing of popcorn, invite people over, and like, we're going to say, okay, we're going to watch Crawl until Crawl doesn't work, and then we'll throw Beastmaster in. And then, here's the thing. So, a lot of the movies, if it's like 2 hours and 5 minutes, they just cut 5 minutes out of the movie. Like, going to put a third disc. But the other thing is, so the image of the movie is huge. So people now, they're collectible because people just want to hang the image on their walls. Like, no, I can play this thing.
Right.
So a lot of like really good movies that are like 2 discs. Like, I have 1 disc of Clockwork Orange.
Oh,
disc of The Elephant Man.
Video well, brother.
Yes. Yes. So yes, but Steve Albini was right. But I think, you know, as we're going through this new industrial revolution. I think young people have just a very different sensibility than those old folks about how to live in the world. And we're almost like in this weird interregnum where there's a new order coming, or there's a new way of living. I mean, unfortunately, the transmission of my car died, and I had to buy a new car. And I was like,
right.
Is this the last gasoline car? This is probably the last gasoline car. Yeah. I was hoping to wait enough. I was hoping this car that I had would last another 5 years, and then I could just buy an electric car. But I'm going to get me a gasoline car, right?
There's so many problems with the car industry
that
we could have solved 50 years ago, and it drives me nuts. But I'm not going to
talk
about it.
Yes, no, absolutely. Right? So we're in this moment, right? And I was like, and for me, it's also then how important the past is.
Right.
And how important a like non-simplified, like complex, nuanced past is so important.
I agree, and I'm surprised by how many people don't find value in that.
Yeah.
So I feel like a lot of people are coming back to that, though. Like, everyone's moving to meal services, or, you know, there's so many new like meal prepping things, or everyone's concerned about where their food's coming from, and trying to do things themselves in their houses, and, you know, with the second industrial revolution of everybody going and getting internet jobs in the city, people are forced further and further out. And I think a lot of people are, I mean, more than baby boomers who just want everything that you could put in a microwave, or you know, everything quick and easy. I feel like we're much more, all right, where is this coming from? Where is our clothing coming from?
Now, do you find that sustainable as like something that's passionate, or something that's like a trend you think is going to stick?
I mean, if the chore gets done.
Okay. You know. All right.
Well, I mean, some of it is too. Is like a lot of our environmental damage, right? Was industrialization has made it possible. Like you know, human beings lived a certain way in the world, and our scale of influence and damage was always limited, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly, you know, we got cheap fossil fuel, and we can do anything in the world. You know, we can.
We have wars and arms races.
We can end all life on the planet if we want, you know, and that's great.
I just see like a homecoming to like grandma things, like soap recipes.
Yeah, a lot of things are getting more local. Like big box stores are dying right and left because there are smaller local places that are doing everything better.
Right.
And like I think cottage industry is becoming big because everybody's got some kind of side hustle nowadays.
Yes.
Yeah, even craft beer. As you know, as like cliche as it is, but I think you're right. Like, those little things are just so interesting.
Yeah.
And I guess for me, it's like part of even why, you know, wanted you all to be on this podcast, or why I do this podcast, is like, you know, for me now, like, big band, I don't know. Like, I don't know what a lot of stuff sounds like that's like really popular.
I don't either.
You know, but like, yeah, there's like a good $5 show we're probably missing tonight because we're doing this podcast.
Right.
That's incredible and wonderful, and those people are smart and passionate and talented and cool and doing things that are way more interesting than, you know, who might be playing PPG tonight or something.
I agree.
Well, they say now you're not famous for 15 minutes, you're famous for 15 people. You know, there's a way to be like a middle-class musician and find your fans and find the people that are going to be passionate about what you're doing if you take the effort to do it.
Which is, I mean, it's the old Minutemen adage, right? A DIY venue, abandon every garage and a DIY venue on every block would be such a wonderful future.
It would be.
For all of us.
Well, let's do it.
I think you are. I think you are doing it. So for folks to find out about Bonnie and the Mere Mortals, and there'll be links and stuff on the podcast, but where for people who want to follow, people who want to hear?
Definitely our Bandcamp and our Instagram, at Bonnie and the Mere Mortals and bonnieandthemeremortals.bandcamp.com. But also we're up on all streaming platforms, so iTunes and Spotify and Google Play and however you listen to your stuff.
Yeah, pretty much anywhere.
It's in your pocket. It's in your pocket right now, people.
Yeah, and we're going to be doing a limited release of cassettes, actually.
Yeah. You know about the cassette shortage, though.
There's
an oxide shortage. It'll be fine by the end of the year. So it'll be fine. You guys will be fine. They're just retooling the plant right now.
Okay.
That makes the oxide.
Well, they started making the 2-inch tape a long time ago, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, so there is actually a company in Pennsylvania.
Oh, really? Okay.
That makes...
I always used to have to buy short ends to get anything.
Yeah. There is a company in Pennsylvania now that will make...
Oh, that's awesome.
Analog.
That is cool.
Recording tape. So Bandcamp, Spotify, there'll be links to everything. What time do you think the record, not to put you on the spot? 2020?
Yeah.
2020. There'll be a new Bonnie and the Mere Mortals record out in 2020. And so to find out about shows, to find out about where to see Yinz live.
Facebook,
Facebook, Instagram.
Instagram, you can use the Google. And so now I think it's time for the bottom five. Bottom five of the series of... Oh, everybody looked at each other like, wait, what? Okay, the bottom five is a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature.
I love it.
And since you talk about how well you collaborate as a band and songwriting, This is an example for folks at home to see the group psychology a bit.
Okay.
So, whenever I have a band or multiple guests on, the bottom five, you must come to a consensus. You're allowed to talk it out loud in front of the hot mic terms of how to answer this question, but you must have one answer. So
okay.
It's not like everybody has an individual answer. Mm. You must come to a consensus.
All right, we'll give it a try.
Okay, I hope this isn't the end of Bonnie and the Mere Mortals, but... Question one, everybody gets first time on the podcast. If reincarnation is real and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease or illness would you be?
That's a loaded question. I don't really want to come back as an infectious disease.
You don't, but if you don't have a choice, like Appalachian Gothic music is like in the Buddhist scale. Like
what did you
revert.
Say earlier? You said
immediately I was like Ebola.
Oh, Ebola?
I feel like it's very successful. As
yeah, it is
disease.
Successful.
Yeah.
A lot of hype, at least.
Yeah.
Well,
Ebola has the hype.
Yeah.
That's romantic, or you know, you can get that tuberculosis chic. Like a whole
consumption,
you know.
Consumption, you can even go there.
Consumption.
Consumption.
You got any, you gonna throw anything out here?
At least you're pretty.
I mean, there is that Daniel Dennett idea that ideas are a virus, so.
Oh! I like that.
So what idea then? What idea virus would be the idea?
The idea of a virus?
I'm still on consumption.
I like consumption too.
Did you know that the phrase "it's none of your beeswax" comes from the fact that when everybody had tuberculosis, it became like popular, and people who didn't have tuberculosis really wanted it.
Really?
So they would cover themselves in like actual silver or something to give themselves like a bluish glow, but you couldn't move very well with that. And if you didn't have the money for silver, then you would just cover yourself in beeswax. But if someone touched you or it got really hot, then you'd start melting. It was this whole thing. But it was really rude to comment on that. So if you were like, hey, you're melting a little bit, and they'd say that's not your beeswax.
Well, now that he said that, I'm on board with you.
Because everybody wants it. Everybody wants tuberculosis.
Right. Yeah, I like that. How about you?
Oh.
We gotta come to a consensus here.
For the sake of the order, I will agree.
Okay,
great. See, that's good man psychology. Right, question two. It's in the either or, so this is a little easier. Take a breath. 50-50. It's a 50-50 question. If you had to choose, would you welcome the total elimination of day or night?
I love night, but my psychology of not having any sunlight might drive me crazy.
We already live in Pittsburgh.
Although I would drive myself crazy with... I'm going to go with night. Was it elimination?
Elimination of day.
Elimination of sunlight, then.
Yeah, no more day.
Yeah. No more day.
Yeah, I'm on that, obviously.
Yeah, I would agree.
Big surprise, the goth-influenced band said, we want to live an eternal night. All right, question three. Question three. This one is more open-ended. Name a film world you would like to visit or live in permanently. If you could do like the Gumby thing, but with a DVD box.
Okay.
And you could just live in Willy Wonka or Ghostbusters or whatever. Film world that you would like to live in or at least visit frequently.
Okay. Give me a second.
I mean, I'm just going to say Middle Earth.
Middle Earth. Tolkien, huh? I mean, I was a big fan of Tolkien whenever I was younger. Although, I kind of want to, like, hang out with people from Clockwork Orange a little bit.
Oh, that's a visit, not stay world.
Yeah, that's a visit. That's a visit.
I'd like to continue enjoying Beethoven, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Middle Earth is good. Middle Earth is good. Like, there's a lot of good elements in Middle Earth, you know.
We don't even really need that. We could just go to New Zealand, I guess.
Yeah? Yeah. Might not be quite the same.
Yeah.
And then you got Mordor, but Middle Earth sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. Moving right along. So question four. All right. Here's a good culture geek question. What's one text, and I mean book, film, music, work of art, that you wish more people knew about?
Well, I'm going to say something and you guys aren't going to agree, but Albert Camus' The Myth of Sisyphus. But
more people knew about. You go first.
I'm going to have to think about that one.
Jean-Paul Sartre's No Exit?
No. You're a philosophy man. That's a big no from here.
Well, give me something. I'll tell you if I want to.
Something you wish were sort of in the pop culture canon. Okay, or the literary canon, for that matter.
So, I minored in political science, and there's this one really obscure, well, maybe it's not that obscure, but this text from the 60s by a guy named E.E. Schatzsnyder called The Semi-Sovereign People that I feel like perfectly describes, like, the American political situation today, like, 50 years before its time. So,
what?
Yeah.
I also like a lot of things from Gore Vidal.
Yeah, Gore Vidal has kind of fallen off the...
Yeah. I mean, definitely at least watch that Best of Enemies on Netflix, just to get an idea, but...
Yeah.
See, I'm talking about the 1968 National Convention again, I'm sorry.
You do love to do that.
Yeah, that was an important moment.
Yes, it was. Moment.
Yeah.
I'm lost.
You got nothing? No. Come on, you're the literary...
I know, but everything I think of is, like, really canonical and, like...
Well, what was the name of that Johnstone book again?
Incident on the End of Bayonet Woods. So, I could say that. That'd be good.
Are we not allowed to have separate answers?
Yeah, no, you still have to come to consensus now. That was the first round of discussions and negotiations.
Oh, man.
I think Destin's thing sounds cool.
It does sound cool, but I haven't read it.
None of us know each. Well, I
well,
know.
Could you describe it real quick? I'm really intrigued, actually.
So it starts by describing this idea called the scope of conflict, which is that anyone trying to pursue collective action wants to expand the scope of their conflict to include people who can build coalition with them, even if they're not like people who would necessarily agree with them on all issues. And so, like,
that sounds
for instance,
great.
Like if you, I don't know, if you're like if you're protesting a factory being built in a neighborhood that's going to be bad for the environment there, you can build coalition with like a competitor to that factory who is also a polluter, but they want to undercut the competition. And so it gets at that idea of how conflict just escalates and gets bigger, brings a lot of other people on board.
Cool. And what's the name of the book again, for so people don't have to rewind?
The Semi-Sovereign People.
The Semi-Sovereign People.
That sounds cool. I think it kind of goes with some ideals, too. Let's go with that.
Yeah.
All right. All right. That's good. You guys really do get along. All right. So we're going to end on a 50-50.
Okay.
Which I think I might know the answer to. So if I don't... No, we'll just go with it. All right. If you had to choose... Would you rather live 100 years in the past or 100 years in the future?
Past.
See, living in the past sounds really cool if you can go to the past and be like a rich, affluent white man. But I love the aesthetics of the past, but I also, like, I don't even want to go, like, to anywhere before, like, toilets are readily available.
Yeah.
But, like, screw toilets, I don't care.
You know, I love the aesthetics of it, but I
okay,
like,
well, what's 100 years in the future going to be like?
I don't know.
I don't think it's going to be that great, so that's my main reason.
Do we get to choose where we go?
I guess
if we go 100 years in the past, we're like ramping up to the Great Depression. That sounds crazy.
Yeah, well, you think you're it's 1919, so you're red hot Spanish flu action.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, that's like the last mass plague in the U.S. World War I is ending.
Right, but at least we'd all be, like, connected into something. You know what I mean?
Y'all would be gone. You guys would be off at war.
Yeah.
I'd be living in, like, a one-room house in the mountains.
Okay,
with,
we have
like,
a little bit.
Like, five kids by now.
We're not agreeing here. What do you think?
A coal miner's daughter situation.
I mean, because really this question is about then the known.
Yeah.
Like, would you rather embrace the known? So there's another world war coming and get to see a bunch of other stuff.
There's a lot of unknowns,
though. The Holocaust, you know?
Yeah.
You know, versus, yeah, the radically unknown, considering we're, if we're truly in an interregnum, what's 5 years from now going to look like?
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, let alone 100.
Maybe we could do really well then. Take our knowledge from now and go.
Well, what, do we get to keep our knowledge and go to the past?
Yeah.
You can at least bet on the World Series.
Yeah.
You can at least
I'd have to know about it first.
Just rip that page out of the sports almanac, tuck it in your pocket, go in the time machine.
Yeah.
And every October just put your money on.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
You know.
I'll go for it for that. If we have the knowledge of the future that we can bring to the past.
We'll get to live through FDR.
Okay, yeah, pass.
Pass. Yeah. All right. There we go. All right, so again, real quick, recap, BonnieTheMereMortals.com, Bandcamp, of course, if you want to download, stream, own, be, have the Tennessee EP, it's on Spotify, iTunes, you get CD Baby 2,
yep.
Facebook for finding out about upcoming shows,
yes,
all that fun stuff. Thank you all so much.
Of course, thank you.
Yeah,
for doing this. Yes, and let's do it again.
Anytime.
Yes, absolutely. It'd be wonderful. So I think that's about it. Our next episode will eventually happen, and I mean, it'll be about something. I don't know what the next guest is going to be. Our homepage where you can find new and old episodes is GonnaDiePodcast.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podcast Addict. I sometimes remember what these on Mixcloud. You know, you get the classic episodes of Mixcloud.
Okay.
There. Thanks to Andrew Fox for lovely theme music. Follow us on Twitter at Gonna Die Podcast. And We're All Gonna Die is on, of course, Facebook. Thanks to our guests, Bonnie and the Mere Mortals.
You're welcome.
Thank you. You're welcome. Later, meets.